In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis noted that nearly all we call human history is one long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. The cultural mantra most often heard today is don't think, just believe. And that is true whether you find yourself in a church, on a college campus, and even the workplace. Asking questions, especially questions that challenge the status quo, are off limits in many places on many subjects. But does this uncritical approach to life really provide any emotional or intellectual satisfaction? Is it really possible to go through life without assessing the reasons why we believe and act in certain ways, as opposed to believing and acting in certain other ways? The fact is, friends, people want answers to their very serious questions. This in turn means that people believe truth exists, whether they will admit that or not. Do you consider yourself prepared to answer questions from your friends, family, or coworkers? Stay tuned for my conversation with author and apologist Nancy Piercy next on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Hi, friends. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. As always, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. And, of course, listen to every episode on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. My guest for this episode is Nancy Piercy. She's the author of Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, which won a 2005 ECPA Golden Medallion Award, and How Now Shall We Live, co-authored with Harold Fickett and Chuck Colson, which won a 2000 ECPA Gold Medallion Award. Her most recent release, and the subject of our conversation today, is entitled Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. Piercy has been a visiting scholar at Biola University's Torrey Honors Institute, professor of worldview studies at Carnegie University, and Francis A. Schaeffer Scholar at the World Journalism Institute. Currently, she is professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University, a fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, and editor-at-large of the Piercy Report. She holds a BA from Iowa State, an MA from Covenant Theological Seminary, and pursued graduate work in history of philosophy at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Nancy.
Well, thank you. It's very good to be here.
Well, I'm honored to have you on, and I'm a fan of your work. In fact, the books that I just mentioned during the bio I have in my library, and actually taught through How Now Shall We Then Live. Of course, that's been a few years ago now, but that was an excellent book, and it proved to be a useful tool for introducing people to worldview apologetics. So thank you for writing those, Nancy. They're very well written.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Owen. It's been very encouraging to hear that.
Nancy, I know a little bit of your background and have heard your testimony before, but I'm wondering if you would share with our listeners a little bit about yourself, your faith journey, and how you ended up as an author, a commentator, an apologist.
Well, right. What really drives all my writings, and especially my most recent book, Finding Truth, is my own experience, because I was raised in a Christian home, and about halfway through high school began to realize that I really had a secondhand faith. I was really a Christian mostly because of my family background, my parents, and I didn't have any reasons for really knowing that it was true.
Yeah.
I had no personal reasons for that kind of conviction. And I realized that wasn't going to work. That wasn't going to last me my life.
Right.
I had too many secular friends, too many Jewish friends, too many people who believed other things for me to be able to survive as a Christian without having some good reasons for it.
Yes.
And unfortunately, when I began asking questions of my parents and my pastors, no one could answer them. Mm. There were not the kind of resources on apologetics that there are today, to be charitable. They didn't have as much at hand. But no one gave me any kind of answers. Let me just give you some examples.
Sure.
I was talking to a Christian university professor. I thought maybe he would have an answer when I said, "Why are you a Christian?" And all he said was, "Works for me." I thought, well, it's not working for me.
Right.
I had a chance to talk to a seminary dean. Again, somebody with that kind of theological education.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping to get an answer, and all he said was, "Don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes."
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
So it were a psychological phase I was going through.
Mm.
And so those were the kind of answers I was getting, and I realized if that's all Christianity had, then it really did not have substantial answers to the questions I was asking. And it seemed to me a matter of intellectual honesty, and that's how I thought about it, even though I was only about 16. But it was a matter of intellectual honesty that if you didn't have good reasons for something, you shouldn't say you believe it,
right,
whether it was Christianity or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really needed to set it aside and embark on a search for what was really true. If I didn't have any adults helping me, I guess it was up to me.
Yeah.
And I started just reading books and literally going down the hallway to the library at the public high school I attended and pulling books off the philosophy shelf. I thought, maybe this is where people answer questions like, what is truth?
Mm, yeah.
What is the meaning of life?
Yes.
How do I know if there's an objective basis for my moral choices? Now, all of these questions that now I was starting to ask, and I could not find any adults to answer.
Mm.
So I went through several years really looking for truth. And I had we had lived overseas when I was a kid, so I went back to Germany when I graduated from high school. And eventually ended up at the ministry of Francis Schaeffer in Switzerland, which is called Labrie.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I encountered Christians who dealt with apologetics and who could give reasons, who could show that Christianity did have answers to the secular worldviews that I had embraced by that time.
Yes.
And so that's because this was such an important part of my own life, I did become Christian eventually through the work of Labrie and Francis Schaeffer. And so, because this is so foundational to my own development, intellectually and spiritually, this is what drives all my writing now, is to help young people like me,
yes,
who weren't getting any answers, to get answers to how they can be sure Christianity is true and how they can be sure that it has the resources to answer the questions posed by competing religions and philosophies.
Yes. I think that it's fair to say that a good many Christians, especially young people who are at that stage where they're asking questions, Nancy, really could be described as practicing agnostics. They've really assimilated secular worldviews into their thinking, and they're not even aware of that. And I think one of the issues in you hit the nail on the head, is that when questions are asked of religious leaders, be they pastors, elders in the church, even parents, when questions are asked, it seems that these authority figures are not equipped to answer those questions. It's a very serious mistake that parents and church leaders make when they try to sidestep answering those questions, don't you think?
Well, when I was researching my latest book, Finding Truth, I discovered studies that were done asking young people why they left the religion of their family. And the answer they found most often was unanswered doubts and questions. And the researchers themselves were surprised because they had been primed to think young people have questions because they've got, you know, a break in their relationship with their parents. So they've been emotionally wounded by somebody at church. You know, they assumed it was going to be some personal issue like that.
Yeah.
But the top reason given by young adults was that they were not getting answers to their questions.
That should be.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
This is what Christian leaders, pastors, parents need to really take to heart, is the empirical evidence is showing us that the main reason young people are leaving the Christian faith is that they have unanswered doubts and questions.
Yes.
We need to start thinking of talking to young people as a form of cross-cultural missions. That cultural change is happening so quickly today that teens are exposed to ideas and worldviews that are very different from those of previous generations.
That's right.
And so our job is to study the language and the thought forms of our children's generation just as carefully as if we were preparing to travel to a foreign country as a missionary.
Yeah.
We have to have a missional mindset, even with our own kids.
Yes.
And, of course, the reason for that ultimately should be driven by love. Apologetics should always be driven by love. That we love people enough that we take them seriously. We take their questions seriously. We listen to them. We're willing to do the hard work of finding answers to their questions. They may not be the same questions we had because cultures change. And that's why sometimes people dismiss those questions. Cause, well, I didn't have those questions when I was young. Well, but our kids do.
Yes.
So we have to do the hard work of finding answers.
Well, parents are quick to say, and I would agree with this, that the times have changed from when we were kids, and so the questions are going to be different as well. Our children are being inundated with all kinds of data and information and very persuasive rhetoric as to why Christianity fails. And I imagine some of our listeners, Nancy, a good many pastors and other church leaders are part of my audience, and I imagine that some of them are just a tad bit nervous right now because they understand that maybe they have a little bit of work ahead of them to prepare themselves to answer these kinds of questions. But it's really a challenge that I think church leaders need to take up, because the alternative is that young people are going to continue to leave the church, and that's just not acceptable.
Well, what I find in my book, Finding Truth, what I offer is an approach to apologetics based on Scripture.
Yes.
And I think this makes it so much easier for pastors and teachers. The typical apologetics book has a lot of arguments, abstract arguments for the existence of God and so on. It can be kind of daunting to get into some of those abstractions and the logic. But in Finding Truth, I start with Scripture. I start with Romans 1.
Yes.
And personally, I find this really exciting because, you know, it ties apologetics to what we love most. We love most God's Word.
Yes.
God's truth.
Yeah.
And it makes it so much more accessible.
Yeah.
That if you start with Romans 1, and Romans 1, as you know, is where Paul talks about general revelation.
He's
talking about how do you make the case for God to people who are not Christian or are having doubts and not quite sure what they do believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so he makes the argument for people who don't necessarily accept Scripture. And he starts with saying that everyone who rejects the biblical creator, who exchanges the glory of God for something in creation, right? That's Romans 1:23.
Yeah.
So exchange the glory of God for something in creation, which means an idol.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't necessarily mean a golden calf. It can mean anything that you put in the place of God,
yes,
as the ultimate reality, as the eternal, self-existent, uncaused cause of everything else that exists. So today, it's less likely, in fact, to be something concrete like a statue, but it could very well be something abstract, like matter.
Yes.
Is matter part of the created order? Well, sure it is.
Sure.
So the philosophy of materialism qualifies as an idol,
yeah,
in the biblical sense. Well, what about reason? Can reason be an idol?
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yes.
So the philosophy of rationalism is a philosophy that puts human reason in the place of God as the source and standard of all truth.
Hmm.
And so when we encounter the world of ideas for the first time, it's easy to get overwhelmed. It's easy,
yeah,
to think this is, you know, this is going to be hard work. The scripture is telling us don't get distracted by the details.
Yeah.
Cut to the heart,
yes,
by asking, what is its idol? Because,
yeah,
whatever functions as this God substitute is going to shape everything else. And that really simplifies the task of, how, of, you know, the beginning steps of evaluating non-Christian worldview.
Yes.
First of all, find its idol.
Well, that's one of the outstanding things about your book, Nancy, Finding Truth. It's subtitled again for our listeners, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. So it's not limited to just atheism and secularism, but it's going to tackle some other things. And the book lays out a very clear outline. And I do want to add, too, for our listeners that you've even included a study guide in the back of the book that is great for one-on-one or even small group study. And you've already mentioned that you start with the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans, and especially chapter 1. And in your book, if I recall, you actually call Romans 1 an apologetics training manual. And then from that passage in Romans 1, I think starting at about verse 18 or 19, you go on to identify five principles or strategies that every Christian can very easily employ to analyze competing worldviews. And I do want to say something about worldviews for our listeners, Nancy, and then I'm going to let you elaborate on these five principles. When we talk about a worldview, we're simply talking about how someone interprets the data that they see. How do they interpret that, and what meaning does that have for them, and then what behaviors or decisions are made on that basis. And so by that definition, every person has a worldview, whether they can describe it as such or not. And so one of the great things about your book is that you outline these principles. And so I'd like, if it's okay, Nancy, to look at, because what you've done is you've taken five principles and you've devoted an entire chapter to each one of those principles. Very in-depth, but also very readable, very understandable for our listeners. So I guess what I'm doing, I'm plugging the book and I'm encouraging people to go out and buy the book and use it in your group studies. But these five keys, let me give them to our listeners, and then I'll have you discuss them, Nancy. But the five principles are this from the book, five strategic principles for analyzing any worldview. Number one is identify the idol. Identify the idol. And I'll let you explain what that means in a moment, Nancy. Secondly, identify the idol's reductionism. Third, test the idol. Fourth, test the idol. Does it contradict itself? Fifth, and then replace the idol. Make the case for Christianity. Nancy, in chapter 1, entitled Twilight of the Gods, here you're identifying the idols, and that's a very necessary starting point. So could you walk us through what you talked about in chapter 1?
Yeah, I liked what you were saying a minute ago when you said, what is a worldview? And in Romans 1, Paul is essentially saying every worldview starts with an idol. Every worldview starts by, you can't think without some starting point.
Right.
And if you don't start with God, you're going to start with something else. You have to have some sort of logical starting point from which everything else flows. And you were saying, what is a worldview? It's a lens through which we see the world. And I was talking to a mother the other day whose child was about to go off to college, and I was giving her some of the isms that she was likely to encounter, and she was like, my kid's going to encounter that and that and that. And I said, well, wait a minute, yes.
Yes.
Let's take just when we talked about materialism, matter is the idol. Matter is the ultimate. Everything is reducible finally to matter. You have to realize that that is the underlying assumption in virtually every subject area today.
Yes.
Whether it's in psychology, people like Freud, mm-hmm. whether it's in biology, ever since Darwin, mm-hmm. whether it's education, John Dewey, whether it's political science, people like Marx, or law, Oliver Wendell Holmes, just to cite some of the key figures in each of these fields. Mm-hmm. No matter what field you are in, your child is going to need to understand materialism because it's the underlying worldview for all of the theories in those fields. And if they're not ready, here's another tragic story. I met a woman not too long ago whose son had gone off to the local state university to study psychology. And psychology, like all of the others, most of the theories are secular. Most of them are anti-Christian. His teachers treated Christianity as a sign of emotional immaturity, that you just won't grow up, and therefore you project an imaginary father for you into the sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even though he came from a very warm, loving Christian home and church, he was completely unprepared to answer those kinds of isms. And in the first semester, he had lost his faith.
Yeah.
And so this is why it's so crucial that we equip our young people with the ability to go below the surface and say, okay, this is a worldview. This is an ism. Let me, what are the basic isms that are going to be taught in this field, and what are the underlying idols that drive each of the isms? And Romans 1 is incredibly relevant to our own day because it teaches us how to go under the surface and find what is the core commitment in each one of these worldviews.
Yes.
And then the next principles will follow from there. But that is the crucial first step.
Yes.
Can you identify the idol that's driving the series that you hear in the classroom? One more story. I just can't read this one because I can't resist telling you this one. It came
from
an email about 3 days ago from one of my former students. She's another psychology student. She said, I just started a graduate program at the University of Houston. I live in Houston. I teach at Houston Baptist University. So she's at the University of Houston. She's gone off to a secular university. She said, I had never heard before that Christianity is a worldview, and I'd never heard before all of these isms that are common in psychology. And I won't list them all because they're all polysyllabic words. positivism and logicism and so on. She said, listen, I'd never heard those before I took your class. Now I hear them in every single class or in every single textbook. If I hadn't had your class, I would be a shipwreck by now.
Perfect.
So our young people need to know the isms they're going to encounter before they get to the classroom so that they have their answers ready.
And Nancy, just for clarity's sake for our listeners, would you explain what materialism is and why it has no position or no ability, really, to critique the supernatural?
Sure. Yeah. The most consistent versions of materialism deny the reality of anything beyond matter.
Yes.
Matter is the ultimate that exists. Everything needs to be reducible to matter.
Yeah.
So there's really no soul,
right.
No spirit, no mind, no will.
Yeah.
Anything that goes beyond the material is simply denied.
Yes.
And humans are reduced to biochemical machines.
Yes.
So Richard Dawkins, most of us know him since he's such an outstanding, well-known atheist. Richard Dawkins says, human beings are survival machines.
Mm-hmm.
They are robot vehicles blindly programmed by their genes.
Yeah.
So you say to yourself, why would anyone hold a view like that?
Yes.
Why? What's the appeal of such a negative and inhumane view of the human person? They're basically biochemical machines.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is, if we can reduce humans to purely natural forces, then we can explain their origin. by purely natural forces.
Yes, that's
and then
it.
There's no need for a creator.
Yeah. And that's very problematic, as I'm sure you're going to touch on as we work through these five principles, that viewpoint that denigrates the value of human
that's
life.
Right.
Yeah, that
that's
presents...
Right. We're jumping ahead a little. That's
yeah,
like
yeah.
It's a strategy for suppressing the evidence from general revelation.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Paul says people do.
That's exactly right. So chapter one is devoted and is entitled Twilight of the Gods. So there you're identifying the idols, and we've been talking about materialism. That is an idol. And what we mean by that is that it takes the place of God. Materialism has taken the place of God for many, and you mentioned Dawkins as one example. And so that's a necessary starting point. So what flows from that, the second principle, and you devoted chapter two to that, how Nietzsche wins, there you're demonstrating the principle of reductionism.
Right. Reductionism just means you reduce human status and human value to something less.
Yes.
And you see, those who exchange the glory of God for something in creation will also exchange the image of God for something in creation.
Yes.
Because an idol is something less than God, lower than God, it will always lead to a lower view of humanity. So like we just saw, if you're a materialist, you're going to deny anything that's not material. You're going to reduce human beings to complex biochemical machines. Of course, it doesn't work.
Right.
Are we really just biochemical machines? All of us make choices from the moment we wake up in the morning.
That's right.
We don't live like a robot.
Right.
One philosopher jokes, if people deny free will, then when ordering at a restaurant, they should say, just bring me whatever the laws of nature have determined that I will get. the beauty of this argument is again, as Paul tells us, we're referring to general revelation. You don't have to believe the Bible to recognize
that
materialism
right.
does not match reality. It's not true to human experience, to what we know about ourselves. We know that we make choices. We know we're not just complex machines. And so you can make this argument. You can equip your young people to make this argument when they're having doubts about the Bible or when they're facing questions from their secular friends or from a secular classroom.
Yes. Yes, that's right. So idolatry always leads to reductionism, which really leads to destructive thinking and behavior because humanity is thought to be much less than what it is, which is image bearers. So those that subscribe to this try to live a completely material existence that makes no allowance for the what Francis Schaeffer called the upper story or the supernatural aspect of life. Now, from that context, Nancy, and you give a lot of good details in your books, very wide in its net, the net that you cast. What are some of the problems that arise from this kind of thinking that devalues human life? What happens in a culture concerning race, concerning class, concerning gender?
Right. If you have a low view of the human person, how are you going to treat people?
Yeah.
You're going to treat them as less than human.
Right.
And it is easiest to see this when it's fleshed out in history. The 20th century was the bloodiest ever in human history.
Yes.
And most of the carnage was driven by atheist totalitarian regimes, like Nazism and communism. So what was the idol in Nazism? How did it define people?
Yeah.
Well, it was your race.
Yes.
Your race determined your worth, your value, your standing in society.
Yes.
The Nazis claimed to be Aryan. And if you were the wrong race, if you were Jewish or Slavic or Gypsy, you could be herded into ghettos, shipped off in boxcars to concentration camps and thrown into the ovens. Or communism. What was the idol of communism? Think back to Marx. Marx was an economic determinist. So class, economic class, was the idol.
Yeah.
Capitalist versus proletarian. Your economic class determines your worth, your value, your standing in society.
Yeah.
And if you were the wrong economic class, you could be put in prison, shipped off in boxcars to hard labor camps, or shot. And so this explains why Romans 1 starts with idols and ends with that long list of destructive behaviors. Most of us are familiar with that part of Romans 1.
Yes.
You know, the whole second half of Romans 1 is a list of all the destructive behaviors that people engage in. And that's why, because it's saying every idol leads to a lower view of human dignity, which in turn leads to violence and oppression.
Yes, yeah. And then the third principle, then, that you outline in chapter 3 that you have entitled Secular Leaps of Faith, here you're testing those idols. Does the worldview that they describe and defend, does it really match reality?
Right, and we touched on it briefly when I said, when you go to a restaurant, do you say, you know, just bring me whatever the laws of nature have determined that I will get?
Right.
Nobody lives like a machine, even though that is the dominant worldview in the academic world today. I give a lot of examples in Finding Truth. What I did is I hunted down examples of secular atheists who themselves admit they don't live that way.
Right.
And here's the one that my my students always remember the best because it's so poignant. And this is Rodney Brooks of MIT.
Hmm.
I mention MIT because these are leading thinkers. These are not fringe people.
That's right,
He was the head of the artificial intelligence lab at MIT and wrote a book called Flesh and Machines. And in that book he says a human being is nothing but a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. Now, in ordinary life, he says, I know it's difficult to actually see people that way. It's just a big bag of skin full of biomolecules. But, he says, when I look at my children, and this is a direct quote, when I look at my children, I can, when I force myself, see that they are machines.
Wow.
But is that how he treats them? Of course not.
Of course not,
In the next sentence, he says, I give them my unconditional love. And then admits, he says, this has no rational analysis within my own world, worldview. Because, of course, robots don't love.
That's right.
So Brooks is admitting that his philosophy is too limited to account for reality as he himself experiences it. And this is one of the wonderful things out of Romans 1, since it's dealing with general revelation, it's dealing with, it's instead of just saying to somebody, well, let me tell you what the Bible says, well, and they say, I don't believe the Bible, say, let me show you your own worldview contradicts what you yourself live.
Yes.
So everyone has a profound experiential sense of being made in the image of God, with the ability to make moral choices.
Yes.
To love our own children. And that knowledge keeps breaking through, even for those whose worldview tells them that they're machines made in the image of matter.
Yes.
And that's why Paul says general revelation is so compelling that people are without excuse.
Yes. Yeah. And that really is, that is a very important point. And I want our listeners to grasp what you are saying there. Those such as the MIT professor that you mentioned, Rodney Brooks, that live that way one way in their professional life, but in their personal life they live in a completely different way. That has to create for them. That has to create some type of cognitive dissonance. They're living two inconsistent worldviews or belief systems, and they have to know that. And so if we use scripture such as Romans 1 to point that out, we're actually coming on to the field where they live, and that has to make sense to them. Don't you think, Nancy?
Well, I think it's what Paul is implying in Romans 1 when he says, he talks about those who exchange glory of God for something in creation.
Yeah.
And then it says, how does God deal with them? He gives them up.
Yeah.
What? That's not what we would expect.
Right.
But what the text is implying is that he's letting them say, okay, fine, live out your worldview and see where it leads you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's exactly what is happening with these people. They're living it out and seeing that it leads to cognitive dissonance, that
yeah.
their worldview keeps contradicting their own experience.
Yes.
Another example, Steven Pinker, one of the best-known sort of public intellectuals today, a cognitive scientist, formerly at MIT, now at Harvard, and he wrote a book in which he said, when I'm in the laboratory, I treat people as complex data processing machines. That's his favorite phrase. We are data processing machines.
Wow.
And then he literally says, but when our work winds down for the day and we take off our lab coats, we go back to treating one another as free and dignified human beings.
Mm.
And that's a direct quote, too.
Wow.
In other words, when you go home to your wife and kids, you can't treat your wife like a data processing machine.
That's
if
right.
you expect to be married very long.
That's right.
And it was an amazing admission that his own worldview doesn't fit his own experience, that
mm-hmm.
he's experiencing that cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And God is, in a sense, letting him live out his worldview. To the point where the contradiction with reality is just glaring, that he himself has to say, I have to leave my worldview behind when I go out into the real world.
Yes.
You know, I can use it at work when we're dealing with theoretical things, but
yeah.
as soon as I go out into the real world, I have to leave my worldview behind.
Yes.
Well, you and I would say to him, shouldn't that make you rethink your worldview? Doesn't that make you think you should maybe
yeah.
go back to the drawing board and come up with a worldview that fits the real world?
Yes.
Isn't that what a worldview is supposed to do?
Yes.
Is to give you a map of the real world that you can actually live
yes.
on its basis.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. There's freedom, rest, and peace of mind in that. Being a believer, of course, I have my own biases and presuppositions, but it's still hard for me to understand how someone can really live a fulfilling, both in career and family life, holding dueling, inconsistent, incompatible worldviews. Now, in your book, Nancy, you really pressed that point, and I thought chapter 4 was great. You've entitled that "Why Worldviews Commit Suicide." So there, you're picking up on the fact that worldviews other than Christian theism have issues matching up with reality, and that's a well-known truth. So you push that point in chapter 4, "Why Worldviews Commit Suicide." There you're examining worldviews for contradictions. You're really asking the question, are they self-refuting? And take us through that chapter.
Yeah, I really love the way Romans is giving us a scriptural basis for all apologetics arguments. All apologetics arguments are going to fall in one of those two camps that you just described. You either test it against the real world, and it better match,
mm-hmm.
or you test it for internal consistency.
Yes.
All arguments end up being either one of those two. And Romans is giving us the basis for why they work. So the second one is internal consistency. And again, it has to do with that reductionism, the idea that you have a lower view of the human person. When a worldview reduces the human person to something less than fully human, when it says they're just complex biochemical machines or whatever.
Yes.
That includes our mind,
yes.
rationality,
yeah.
reason.
Uh-huh.
But then how do they argue their own case?
Mm.
Well, they have to use reason.
Right.
So when they debunk reason, they undercut their own case.
Yeah.
So let me give you some examples from some of the isms that are very common on today's
yes.
university campus.
Yeah.
We mentioned Marxism. Marxism says, you don't think the way you do because you're rationally persuaded it's true, but because it advances your economic interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, to be consistent, Marx has to apply that same theory to his own views.
Yep. That's right.
Well, did he come up with his own views just to advance his own economic interest? In which case, why should the rest of us pay any attention to it?
That's right.
He shoots himself in the foot.
Yeah.
Well, Sigmund Freud had an enormous influence on the modern mind. Because you don't believe what you believe because you're rationally persuaded it's true, but because of your psychological history, especially sexual repression.
Yeah.
Oh, well, what does that imply for the origin of his own theory?
Mm-hmm.
Onto the couch yourself,
yeah.
Dr. Freud.
Yeah.
Well, postmodernism, that's kind of an esoteric term that's hard for many people to get their minds around, but it's really just saying that human rationality is swamped by non-rational social forces like race, class, and gender. So, what about their own theory?
Yeah.
Are they just mouthpieces for their own race, class, and gender? In which case, why should we pay any attention to them?
That's right.
So, the phrase commit suicide is a phrase I got from an apologist named Greg Kokel. And he says that the theory is committing suicide because it's applying its, when its own criterion of truth is applied back onto itself,
yes,
it kills itself.
That's right.
It discredits itself. It splits its own throat.
Yes.
There's a technical term for this, of course. It's called self-referential absurdity.
Yes.
But you can see why my students prefer to say it commits suicide.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's a standard tool in any philosophy or apologetics toolbox. I read it all the time. You know, I'm reading philosophy books all the time.
So, mm-hmm.
I'll read a book that'll accuse, you know, it'll analyze this theory and say it commits suicide. It'll analyze that theory and say it commits suicide. It'll analyze that theory. And I finally get overwhelmed. You know, I love this stuff, and I get overwhelmed. So think of your ordinary pastor or parent.
Yes.
They're going to get overwhelmed if they just try to memorize an argument for every theory out there.
Right.
So instead, you go to Romans 1.
Mm-hmm.
Romans 1 explains how it works and how to apply it.
Yes.
You identify the reductionist view of the human person and the reductionist view of reason, and that's the point where this theory will be self-refuting.
Yes.
And Christianity doesn't have this problem. It has a high view of reason.
Yes.
Our minds reflect the divine mind.
Yes.
And so what that means is every other philosophy essentially has to borrow a Christian view of reason,
mm-hmm. yeah.
at least at the moment when they're making their own claim.
Yes.
Otherwise, they commit suicide.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful segue into chapter 5, because as I read that, I thought, well, this is... I wrote a paper some years ago that I was... privileged and honored to deliver at an annual meeting of the International Society of Christian Apologetics in Deerfield there at Trinity, and it was on the new atheism, and the point of the paper that I presented was that atheism, the new atheism, is blatantly smuggling in Christian morality. But acting as if they're not. And I picked up a sense of that in your chapter 5 that you've entitled, I love the title, Nancy, Freeloading Atheists. And here you're showing that all worldviews to some extent, and this is my own interpretation of what you wrote there, and you can correct me if I've misrepresented that, but... that all worldviews to some extent smuggle in Christian morality, and that is especially the case with atheism, and so they're really standing upon false foundations for their beliefs.
Yeah, in finding truth, I suggest if you want to be really relevant in your apologetics, then why not answer the questions people are actually asking? And why not look at the points where they themselves admit that their worldview fails? And one of the ways they admit it, at least tacitly, is when they have to reach over and borrow something from Christianity. Like, as you said, we just said they have to essentially borrow a Christian view of reason when they're making their own case.
Yes.
But here's another example that I found several atheists essentially admitting. One of the great ironies of our age is that there are more movements than ever before for human rights, equality, dignity, freedom.
Yes.
But as we've been talking about, the dominant worldviews of our day, like materialism, deny the existence of free will.
Yes.
Give no basis for rights or dignity because they say we're just essentially complex robots.
Yes.
So where did the idea of equal rights and freedom even come from?
Yes.
Well, back in the 19th century, the great atheist Nietzsche said it came from Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
He said, the equality, the concept of the equality of souls before God furnishes the prototype of all theories of equal rights.
Yes.
Another atheist who died recently, but he was a well-known American philosopher named Richard Rorty. And he said, I'm a materialist, I'm an evolutionist, I'm a Darwinist. And in the struggle for existence, the strong win and the weak are left behind. So clearly, that cannot be the source of the concept of universal rights.
Mm.
Where did it come from?
Yes.
He said it came from the biblical teaching that all human beings are created in the image of God.
Yeah.
His grandfather was a Christian pastor.
Mm.
So he says, I have to reach over and borrow the idea of universal rights from our Christian heritage. And he's the one who actually uses the term freeloading atheist. He says, I am a freeloading atheist, and admits that he has to freeload the concept of human rights from Christianity.
Yeah.
And, one final example is a British atheist named John Gray, who's a contemporary atheist. He says, Darwin has shown us we are animals. And therefore, any attempt to frame an atheist concept of human dignity is only a secular version of Christian faith. It's a derivative of Christianity.
Yes.
So the exciting thing is that elements of a Christian worldview are so compelling and so attractive and so appealing that even non-Christians keep trying to claim them. They're all freeloading atheists. And we come back to Paul. No wonder he said he's not ashamed of the gospel. These five principles in finding truth show that the Christian worldview is not only true, but it's also more attractive and more appealing than any alternative worldview.
Yes, that's right. Well, your book, Nancy, is a very clear call for people of faith to think critically about what they believe. Why is this a challenge today among believers? You as a university professor, an apologist, a very wide read and widely read your books. In your experience, why is it such tough sailing to get believers to understand the necessity of thinking critically?
Well, here we have to dip back into my earlier book, Total Truth. I have a whole section there, four chapters, on how we lost a Christian mind, how American evangelicals lost that sort of intellectual heritage. And it's a long story, but in essence, a lot of it was that American evangelicalism was shaped by the First and Second Great Awakenings.
Yes.
And there was a lot of good that happened then. A lot of people got converted.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is the main reason that Americans are more religious than all the other industrialized nations. So there's a good thing.
Yeah.
But it also had some negative baggage, and that is that the revival tended to treat Christianity as focused on a intense emotional conversion experience. It tended to underplay the intellectual side of belief, the cognitive side of belief, of teaching, doctrine, catechisms, and so on. And we're still dealing with a lot of the fallout of that period, where there was sort of a negative view of the intellectual understanding of Christianity and a focus on just emotional experience. And unfortunately, if anything, it's gotten worse, because of the secular world is so hostile that a lot of Christians think the way to deal with intellectual challenges is to redefine Christianity as just my personal experience, because nobody can challenge my personal experience.
Right.
So
yeah.
If I define it in terms of emotional experience, therefore it will become immune to outside challenges. Well, it doesn't work. We're made in God's image. We're not just emotional beings. We're rational beings. And so ultimately, it doesn't work. And we run into what's happening today, where there's the hemorrhaging from the church of our young people because they're not getting their questions answered.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is because of that historical heritage. And Total Truth, I have had so many people come up to me after reading Total Truth and say, your book just explained my whole life to me. They said, I always knew something was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Because when you go up for that historical perspective and you see that anti-intellectualism developing over time, you understand it a lot better. And you say, okay, now that's why I tend to hear this. Here's an example. I went to seminary. I have an MA from the seminary. And, of course, there were all these jokes about seminaries being cemeteries.
Sure, yeah.
Because right? If you go to seminary, the idea being, well, if you have an intellectual understanding of your faith, somehow that will kill the spiritual side of your faith. Well, that's not true.
No, not at all.
But where would we get that kind of negative stereotype?
Mm-hmm.
It's because of that the history of the First and Second Great Awakenings.
Mm.
And so the easiest way to get a handle on it is to go back and look at that history so that we understand sort of the unspoken stereotypes and assumptions that we need to overcome in our own minds as well as other people's minds in order to recognize the need to think critically and to develop a Christian mind.
Excellent. The name of that book is Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity. Nancy, on the inside dust cover of your book, Finding Truth, the front flap says that Finding Truth demonstrates that Christianity is not only true but attractive. Now, my hope is that our conversation in this episode of the program has done that for people. It has shown why the Christian faith is very attractive. But I wonder if you would speak to that. How is Christianity more appealing than the competing worldviews that we see today?
Yeah, let's. I think Romans 1 still gives us an answer to that as well, because what it says is, if you look at nature or creation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
General revelation is that we look at creation, and Romans teaches us that evidence for God is clearly seen in the created things. Like that's Romans 1:20.
Yeah.
Now, typically, we think this passage refers to the beauty and complexity of nature.
Mm-hmm.
As heavens declare the glory of God. And it does. But it also refers to humanity, and you don't hear that argument made.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the argument I make in Finding Truth.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are part of the created order.
That's right.
And we too give evidence for God.
Yeah.
And how is it? Well, think of it this way. The cause must be equal to the effect. So because humans are capable of choosing, the first cause that created them must have a will. Because humans are capable of thinking, the cause that created them must have a mind. Or as one Christian philosopher sums it up, because a human is a someone and not a something, the source of human life must also be a someone and not the blind automatic forces of nature, as philosophies like naturalism and materialism tell us.
Yeah.
Or as the Bible puts it elsewhere, he who planted the ear, does he not hear?
Mm, yes.
He who formed the eye, does he not see?
Yes.
So the case for a creator fits our most universal experience of human nature, what we all know about ourselves. Again, general revelation is so compelling that people are without excuse.
Yes,
but you see,
right.
As soon as you get rid of the creator and recreate the image of, humans in the image of something in creation, you're going to end up with human beings being a something and not a someone.
Mm-hmm.
You will always have them being something less than the Christian view. This was so exciting when I was working on Finding Truth.
Yeah.
Is that you don't have to wait around to examine every philosophy out there or every religion out there.
Yeah.
You can know. It's logically inescapable that if you don't start with a creator God, you're going to start with something less.
That's right.
And therefore, you will have a lower view of the human person. It will be less personal, less humane. You know, you'll either have human beings basically an organism, a complex animal, or a machine, as is the more common view today,
mm-hmm.
or you'll have Eastern religion where human beings, their personality is a bad thing.
Yeah.
They should dissolve their personality and merge with the one,
yes.
the all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So no matter whether it's religion or philosophy, you will always have a lower, more negative, less humane view of the human person. And therefore, you can always craft a positive argument for Christianity.
Yeah.
We tend to have negative arguments for Christianity, right? You're a sinner. You need to get saved.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
But you're a sinner is only a tragic story because we were something so wonderful to start with.
Mm.
We were made in God's image to start with. We had this
right.
value, purpose, and dignity.
Yeah.
That the fall is really tragic.
Mm-hmm.
If we're just a piece of junk to start with, then
yeah.
if it's broken, who cares?
Who cares,
but
yeah.
it's because we have such value and dignity that the fall is so tragic.
Yes.
So we can always go back to the creation and make a positive case for Christianity.
Yes.
Over against any other religion, it's going to have a higher view of the human person, of human dignity, and human value than any other philosophy out there.
Yes. Amen. Amen. Your website is nancypearcey.com. Nancy and Piercy is spelled P-A-R-C-E-Y, nancypearcey.com. People can keep up on with what's going on with your work. Are your books available through your website, Nancy?
You know, no, they're not.
Okay.
No, you have to go to christianbook.com or
yeah.
Amazon,
okay.
Yep. Barnes & Noble.
The normal places, yeah. And your speaking schedule, do you have that out there on your website?
We're trying to get these things up. I need more assistance.
Yeah.
We will be getting them up.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for asking.
Well, there's another website I want our listeners to know about, and that's the piercyreport.com, piercyreport.com. Could you tell us a little bit about that, Nancy?
Right. The publisher is my husband,
yes.
Rick Piercy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a news website, but it's geared towards people who care about Christian worldview. So
yes.
it has news, commentary, and articles. But it's geared toward people who want news that's related to things that that have an impact on Christian worldview. So it's a nice way to stay up to date on current events
yeah.
as they're of interest to us as Christians.
Yes, and I can tell our listeners that it is a gold mine of information. I was out there again today just looking around and all kinds of resources. It's like a one-stop shop for news, so I encourage you to check that website out as well. Any new projects that you're working on, Nancy, you'd like to share with our listeners?
I do have another book coming out, and the next book will be on life and sex issues. The sexuality issues in particular, of course, are so big
yes.
today, and Christians yeah. are, again, sort of floundering a bit in terms of trying to figure out how to talk to non-Christians about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So that will be the goal of this new book, will be how to get at the underlying worldview. You cannot argue moral issues directly, because morality is always dependent on the underlying worldview.
Yes.
We have to learn to argue the worldview behind things like homosexuality, transgenderism, and so on.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to getting a copy of that. When do you expect that to be released?
I don't have a timeline yet. about a year.
About a year. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be very impatiently waiting on that one to come out. I think that would be a very valuable resource, and you're right, that is the top two or three issues that Christians need to be informed about. And what I've seen, unfortunately, is that so many Christians are taking the wrong approach to this, and they are letting compassion, really, in my view, faux compassion, overrule what a true biblical worldview is. But I'll save that for another episode. Nancy, I appreciate you being on the show with me and your work. It's very valuable for believers, and God bless you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, Follow us on Facebook, where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.